Hello again, and welcome to another episode of the Challenge City podcast with me, Ian Montgomery. And this episode is kind of more about trees, well, biodiversity, parks, which is a topic that urbanists tend not to go towards. So when I met Jan Sumner from the Wildlands League, we talked about national urban parks, we talked about trees, we talked about things in cities, we talked about things in the far north of Ontario, and I thought that would make a great conversation to have for Challenger Cities. So really what this is all about is there's things around conservation that are very much around protection and keeping things as they are. There's things that are around taking things back to where they used to be. There's things that are around adapting them to the environment. And what I love about the conversation that we're going to have here is that we talk about things where here's how we create this place like a Rouge National Urban Park that is within reach of 7 million Canadians, so like the best part of a quarter of the country, that people can be accessible, can get people into nature, can get people to understand and care and have empathy for the environment and climate and biodiversity. And then all the little threads that hang off that, so whether that's like things like Meadoway, which you'll talk about, whether that's things around what's happening in people's own backyards. I really just enjoy this conversation for sort of pulling all those threads that actually make places nicer and cleaner and happier and healthier and greener and cooler. So yeah, this is a really, really good one. Without me waffling on more, let's get into it. So this is a conversation all about biodiversity, wildlands, conservation, nature, trees, with Jan Sumner. So Jan, thank you so much for coming on this thing, because we talk about cities a lot, and I think you're really interesting because you talk about wildland and forestry a lot, which is naturally not necessarily where people go to when they think of cities. They think of concrete, steel, glass. But I think trees are really important in this. So I want to make this a conversation of bringing those two worlds together. But before we do that, I'd love to sort of get into chat a little bit about you, a little bit about the Wildlands League, and kind of we'll go from there in terms of how this conversation came about.
Yeah. Well, first I'll say thanks, Ian, for inviting me to be on the podcast. I really appreciate it. I've listened to a few of the episodes, and I'm pleased to be and honored to be on the podcast. So thanks so much for this. A little bit about me. Grew up wanting to be an astronaut. I'm not. And then I started to work as an environmentalist back in the dawn of time. And what I mean by that is 1989. So before this century started, and I often say that I've been a professional troublemaker for that length of time. And what I do is I work on environmental issues. And when I started out, I worked very much on issues around what a traditional environmentalist does, like in terms of waste management, toxic chemicals, and the very beginning of climate change. So I was working on those things. And then about 1998 or so, I switched over, or actually maybe it was a little bit later, maybe it was 2002 or so, I started to look at Canada's contribution in terms of climate change and realized that our forests and keeping the natural world able to absorb carbon and help with the mitigation and adaptation to climate change was actually going to be the biggest contribution that we could make in terms of climate change. We should be looking after nature. So I went about trying to find an organization to go and work for. And it may seem odd to people, but my work on climate change became my work on nature. And so I started working for Wildlands League in 2003, I believe. And I've been the executive director there ever since. And lo and behold, we've been able to look at the natural world through the lens of what we need to do for nature, but also what nature can help us with in terms of climate change and that overlap. And I think there's a saying now, you know, that climate and biodiversity loss are actually all the same issue. They're both existential crises, and it is about the natural world starting to collapse because we are not being good stewards. And so that's a little bit about me. And then in terms of Wildlands League, it started in 1968 with a campaign to take logging out of all provincial parks. And they were very successful at that. They got logging out of all the parks except for Algonquin. So we've been working on removing logging from Algonquin Park since 1968, and we've had advances, we've had improvements. We've taken it from 23% of it fully protected up to 35% of it and 49% of it without logging. They still can build road infrastructure for logging on some of that land, but we've been able to accomplish those things. But we've worked on a much bigger canvas as well. In fact, I worked on caribou conservation planning in Alberta, in Saskatchewan, Manitoba, et cetera. And we really do think in terms of the global imperatives. And so we have also been working on carbon accounting for Canada. And then one of our big projects right now is we're working with Indigenous, Mishkewek Indigenous people in the north. There's 9 communities along the coast of Ontario, and most people in Canada don't know, or even in Ontario don't know, that we have a northern coast, a sea coast, and that is almost 1,300 kilometers long. And we are working on creating a new marine protected area. It's actually called a National Marine Conservation Area. It'll be roughly the size of Portugal, and it will be an achievement for those communities that have wanted to see this happen. And we're working all the way as far south as you can go in Ontario, pretty much, with Caldwell First Nation and other First Nations to create a national urban park. And so we've done a variety of things, whether it's on forestry or mining or working on full protection. I still have very much in my heart, how do we think about climate change and what is coming or what's here? Yeah, it's a little bit about Wildlands League.
There's so many places to go from here. I think you touch it, like the way you suddenly shifted from an area the size of Portugal on Ontario's northern coast to then suddenly national urban parks. And I think there's this thing around when people talk about like wildlands and whatnot, they often go to the very rural or the provincial park type or the state park, whatever it might be, without necessarily thinking about the thing that's there in the backyard. And I think that that's where climate change is as an example of. It's very easy to go, oh yeah, it's important, but how much do I really care because I can't influence it, versus the things that are in your backyard that you can. Maybe play a very, very trivial small part, but if you do that trivial small part hundreds of thousands or millions of times, you end up in a very good place. I think just even just as you gave your intro there, that sort of hooked me in terms of like, how do you handle that sort of, rather than sort of this being like that's a nice to have, how do you make this such a critical piece, whether that's to do with an urban park or whether that's to do with somewhere in the far north of Ontario that even Ontarians don't necessarily think about existing?
Yeah, it's interesting. So when we started down this path of working on protected areas, we've been working on that for a very long time. But one of the things that happened in about, it actually happened with the first mandate for the Trudeau government. And at that time, they had a Minister of Environment and Climate Change Canada, who was Catherine McKenna. And she had the dual portfolio, if you will, of climate change, but also nature. And Canada, actually under a previous Conservative government, had signed on to what was called Target 1. And that was to protect a certain amount of Canada by 2020. And, the conversation when she came into power or when she assumed the minister's role was, well, how the heck am I going to do that? And because I had helped the government actually create Rouge National Urban Park, they asked me to chair a national advisory panel that came out with a unanimous opinion on 35 recommendations on how to meet Target 1 and protect 20% of Canada by 2020. And so, and these were unanimous considerations across. We had Indigenous members. My co-chair was Indigenous, and we had mining association on there. We had agriculture. We had the forestry industry. We had academics. We had other environmental organizations. And all of those people came together and were able to be unified on the fact that we needed to do this and how could you do it. And out of that then became, okay, great plan. How do we do this? One of the big ticket items was to create the challenge fund, which was, of course, how do you get provinces to do something when you might not have the legislative authority to require it or to force it? So that was, what's the carrot? How much money can we put? And that was the first investment, which was $1 billion. And offering it up to provinces and territories that if they contributed hectares to protect across Canada, for that 20%, what would that look like? And so when we started down that path, it was very quickly became the best projects to do then become the ones with the biggest hectares. And we started to see that nothing was happening in these southern places. Mm-hmm. I became very concerned about that because two reasons. One is they're not just an afterthought. And the reason for that is that this is just kind of shocking news, but nature's all connected. Mm-hmm. It's not separate. And the actual goal of the 30 by 30 or the actual goal of the global biodiversity framework is to actually have thriving ecosystems. So it doesn't work if you go and protect 30, let's say you hit that magical target of protecting 30% of Canada, but it's all in the north, mm-hmm. then all of those habitats for migratory species like birds, when they go to fly south, they're not going to have any place to land. Now, not every bird lands. Some of them can make the journey all the way south and fly literally thousands of kilometers, but there are many birds that stop along the way. And what does that look like? And where are they going to stop? And what will then be shut down if we don't have that interconnectivity that goes all the way along those flight paths? And so for me, it was very important to do that on an ecological basis, obviously. And then also to think about, well, if it's not a percentage that we're after, we're after trying to stop this collapse of biodiversity. And so if you're not prepared to go where we're losing the most species, which is actually in our urban and rural areas, then you're not going to halt biodiversity loss. So you have to do that not just from a migratory path place, but also from the place of if the goal is to have thriving ecosystems, then we need to take care of all the ecosystems. And we can't just pick and choose and go, well, we've got these really healthy ones in the north, so let's just protect those. So this is, we had to get our heads around that. And then what you saw Canada do was they came out with a program on national urban parks. And in the, I think it was in the last election, they said they were going to create 15 of them. At last count, I think there are 25 communities across Canada who've all requested or asked to create national urban parks. And I personally know that there are more than those who have asked, made official requests. Mm-hmm. So for example, in Ontario alone, which I know the best because it's our backyard, is Windsor wants to create Ojibwe National Urban Park. We wanted to expand Rouge National Urban Park and create one in London and one in Guelph. And I believe Sudbury has also put in a request for a national urban park. And we've been toying around with the idea of whether or not you could do other national urban parks in other regions. And we've also seen Ontario create a provincial urban park in Uxbridge. So this is just the beginning. And the other thing that it does is if you create urban parks as part of your trying to create healthy ecosystems, then that's where most Canadians live. Like 7 million Canadians live within an hour of the Rouge. That's 20% of Canada. If you have that many Canadians who are directly impacted because you're creating a national urban park in their backyard, then guess what? They become advocates for nature. They become the people willing to be the next generation of stewards. They become the people who, with their voting power, say, this is actually really important for me, and I don't want to let this go. And some of that was also helped by the pandemic because people were flooding to areas where they had, you know, had an opportunity to go and spend time with nature. And it was, you can see all of the happiness factors and all of the health factors, et cetera, that you're just better off if you have access to nature. And so it's not just trees, it's access to nature. And there are more than 2,000 species, for example, in Rouge National Urban Park. And that is kind of it's really quite incredible. You don't really expect that there would be that many species there, but there are.
What makes a national urban park? Is there a sort of criteria for it to become one?
That's actually a really good question.
And right, I thought it was a dumb one for a second.
I think it's a really good question. So they're at this juncture, they're all a little bit different, and we don't have legislation that covers national urban parks. We have a National Parks Act that essentially basically says, you know, ecological integrity is going to be the driving metric or management that it's going to be judged against. Is this area that we've designated, so it, does it have a designated area? Can you see it you know, like you understand what the boundary is. It's protected in perpetuity. And what we're trying to protect is ecological integrity. So it might not start out being, as you can imagine, if it's an urban area, it's not going to necessarily start out as pristine nature or pristine wilderness or wild space. But where you start, you have to basically be building towards and improving the ecological integrity all the way along. So that's what you're trying to do. So Rouge National Urban Park actually has legislation that is specific to Rouge that creates that metric. And that's also what allows it to be counted under the international, the IUCN. So it has to be an area that is defined, has a defined border, has been in perpetuity, and is protecting its ecological integrity. Yeah, and it's improving that as it goes. So, and you could also have what's called an OECM, which is other effective conservation measure. So, for example, there's places where you might have a university that's got a nature reserve that they're using as a study area. So the primary purpose might not be protection, but it has all those other elements. It's defined, its nature is protected, and it's covering its ecological integrity. And in fact, London, Ontario has, under its own municipal powers, has several areas that are designated and are considered protected. I don't know if it's the only city in Canada, but very would essentially be one of the first that had used its own municipal powers to create that. So you can go to the IUCN, you can see those designations, but it's very, very simple. What we're doing right now is we're saying we're going to create national urban parks. There's a policy framework, but there isn't yet a legislative framework. And so we've been working to try and create a legislative framework, and we haven't been successful yet. We actually had a bill, a private member's bill, before the Senate. It was in second reading, I think it was. And when they announced the prorogation of government, then all the bills died, and now they're going to be launching an election. So we'll have to take another run at this and see if we can get legislation. But there are some places that don't want legislation. So I think also, to be fair to Parks Canada, they're trying to be flexible and not have a one-size-fits-all. But I like the idea of legislation, because then a provincial government can't come along and say, oh, you know what, that parcel of land that we included in there, we've decided to sell it. So I'm a little nervous given our experience with what's happened with the Green Belt.
There's almost like a marketing ploy in this as well, where, I mean, you touched on it already, like 7 million people living close to the Rouge National Urban Park. Really nice place, love, like, been for many walks there, spent a lot of time there. You then have a greater, I don't want to use the word empathy, but you have a greater level of care and consideration for the things that you haven't been to or can't necessarily imagine. And I think that that's the, or you also then go, well, how can I do more of this in my own backyard? So I can't do a national urban park in a little suburban neighborhood, but we can go and create, we can go and rewild something and make it a nicer place to spend time in. And that it's, to borrow the old sort of English supermarket phrase, but every little helps, effectively. I think that's so important, so that even if you can't get the legislation there, you can create an almighty noise if some evil politician wants to come along and sell off a bunch of land for development.
Yeah, it becomes untouchable. And certainly, I mean, just to go back a little bit, in terms of how we created Rouge National Urban Park, I mean, it was various parcels of land owned by various different pieces of government: Toronto Regional Conservation Authority, City of Toronto, Ontario Parks. There was federal land. There was all different kinds of ownership. And it's similar in a lot of places. Like, they've got the same thing in Windsor, where you have different parcels of land owned by different forms of government. And so how do you bring that all together under one regime and create that? So one of the things that we did early on was we said, well, let's make it so popular that you can't say no to it. And so we ran a program called Paddle the Rouge. We did that 6 years in a row. We had kids come out, you know, 700 people on a really sunny June day come out and learn how to paddle. And we were also trying to bed in the next generation of stewards for that area. And it became so popular, and politicians loved it. They came out for the day. They got their photos taken, you know, it caught fire. And then it was like, well, you know, how the heck, let's move this forward to legislation. And it was something, we did this very deliberately. But now you've seen, as I said, there were supposed to be creating 6 national urban parks and then 15. And now there's at least 25 who've requested it, probably more, because there's all these unofficial ones that haven't actually put their requests in yet. So I think it's just going to keep going. And then what that does is it spawns all kinds of community groups and other people who want to, maybe they can't get it inside that National Urban Park, but they go, well, maybe we could actually create an ecological corridor that would meet with it. We see, I'm actually the chair of the park, Rouge National Urban Park Advisory Committee. We see the city of Toronto, and we see other cities going, like, for example, Uxbridge, created by the province, is fairly close to Rouge. And so how do we actually create connectivity there? How does the Greenbelt intersect with Rouge? How does, all the other places that are around the Rouge, how do all of those contribute to it? The Meadowway, which is something the city of Toronto has been doing, which is a rewilding of this hydro corridor. It's not going to be a protected area, but it's going to rewild and bring back all kinds of butterflies and places for bees and, you know, pollinators, et cetera. So great. And that's going to be a connectivity corridor that will go across Toronto. And then I would actually even suggest that it takes you down into the lake and you start looking at what's the connectivity, because you've got the Rouge River that runs right down into the lake. And could you be doing a National Marine Conservation Area in Lake Ontario? My feeling is yes, you probably should. The same thing with Lake Erie. And could you create a National Marine Conservation Area near to Ojibwe National Urban Park? So there's all different kinds of ways that we can actually start to reweave the web of life. So it doesn't necessarily, it's not as if the Greater Golden Horseshoe is going to become one massive protected area, but for it to become more resilient in the face of climate change, for it to adapt and actually help mitigate climate change, could it actually have a web of life that was made up of ecological corridors, city parks, national urban parks, heck, even some of the industrial activities where you see these, they might have a building, but they have huge tracts of land. You could be doing rewilding. You could be doing various plantings on there for pollinators. You see people doing pollinator gardens all over the cities now. You see them doing them on rooftops and on their balconies, et cetera. And all of that brings pieces of nature back into play. And all of that can work in harmony together, and we can each participate in that. Even if you don't have any land, there are community gardens. There are ways that you can help with plantings along roadways and things like that, doing rewilding. When we were just down in the city of London, where they had a big exhibit. And the city of London comes out and they have trees that they distribute that people can go out and plant. And so it's, you know, there's all different kinds of ways to participate. And what it will do is it reconnects all of us to nature. And it's also a great act of reconciliation as well, because Indigenous people are connected to the land. They think about it. Chippewas of the Thames are doing amazing work in terms of restoration there. That can actually work as a knitting together, if you will, with London and what it's doing in terms of its municipal park system and its protected areas. So all of this is even going to agricultural lands, where you might see farmers doing restoration, improving the hydrology on their land, and basically doing some rewilding and some plantings that will help nature and will also potentially help them with, you know, soil loss, because it creates a wind barrier break, or might help in terms of holding on to water and helping in drought and flood times. So all of these things can work in harmony with each other if we're more intentional and think about that. Overpasses and underpasses as well are important ingredients in this.
I like how when you talk about the Paddle the Rouge example, but also then the Meadowway being a connectivity corridor, I feel like a lot of the time people can get their backs up around conservationists because they see them as being inhibitors of development and progress, when actually a lot of the things you talk about are a tourism, a leisure activity, a connectivity corridor. There'll be a cycling route alongside it. Towards the end of what you were talking about there, you get to sort of overpasses and underpasses, that while you have the parks that we don't really know about way, way in the north, you have the national urban parks, but then that connects you to all the sort of threads where it doesn't have to be, there's not legislation, there's not protected status, but it's the stuff that people, whether it's individuals or communities or politicians, really care about. And this probably brings me to the thing around, at the end of the day, like a lot of these things, the reason why we care about them is because we go and spend money and time and our leisure in them. And there's a return on investment to this that I don't think is necessarily captured tremendously well. But when you do this well, it has this knock-on impact that makes us happier means that when you get a crazy rain event, it may, hopefully means our basement doesn't flood. But it's also like, it's making us money. Whereas like paving over everything is at the end of the day costing us more money.
Yeah, it definitely can. I think that, you know, Canada has an amazing national park system. And we have some good parks in Ontario, like Algonquin, et cetera. There are provincial parks as well, but they're not next door. You can go to Rouge on public transit. If you take the GO train, you can pass right through the Rouge. If you're in London, Ontario, you can go for, like I grew up in London, and you can go for a walk. You can paddle the Thames. You can do all different kinds of activities that take you into nature. London is known as the forest city. In fact, when you go through there, you see forest city this, forest city that. You know, it's like lots of businesses are called forest city. And in Windsor, Ojibwe is one of the, it's a tall grass prairie, and it's an area that is really holds on to water and helps release it in times of drought. And it's one of the most endangered, I think it is the actual most endangered ecosystem in Canada.
Wow.
So these are all treasures that we have, and we drive by them and we might not realize it. And then that was actually one of the benefits of the pandemic, was because people were getting out and starting to see this. And the other thing about, and I don't want to just harp on Rouge, because I think national urban parks are really important everywhere. But what it was considered was, let's do this because it'll almost be the gateway to Canada's national park system. Because as you've highlighted, not everybody's going to go to Banff. Now, I've been there. It's absolutely beautiful. Yes, you should go. But if you can't get out to Banff, or you can't get to Jasper or some other famous park, then go to Rouge, or go to, you know, Halifax has got a new national urban park. Saskatoon is going to get one. Edmonton wants to see one. They're all over the place. Mm-hmm. And so the more that we can have them, then the more accessible nature is to us, the more grounded Canadians are, and the more in touch we are with our natural world. And the more our natural world can help us in the face of climate change, whether it's, you know, being an area that helps with flood mitigation or drought mitigation or heat relief, like just having enough trees in a city. Destinations now are thinking, or cities now are thinking about, well, what's our tree canopy cover target? What canopy do we want to see in our cities, and where? I know the city of Toronto is looking at, you know, if we have a tree canopy cover, making sure that it's equitable, like that it actually cools all the areas of the city that need cooling.
It's not just between Pye Park and Bathurst.
That's right, right? Yeah, exactly. That we have to think about that. It has to be, some of the new metrics that are coming out are like, is it within a 15-minute walk before you can get out into nature? So where do you live, and within 15 minutes, could you walk there? Could you be a mom with a pram and get out into a natural area? Could you go play with your kids in a natural area? And, you know, there might be swing sets and things like that there, but there might also be a beautiful garden, or places where we've got pollinator plantings, or where we have tall grasses or tree covers that are stuff. And one of the reasons that I started to get excited about the Rouge, for example, and this is going back to the beginning, was because when we had a big ice storm here, it was just over a decade ago. And when that big ice storm hit, the trees that did the best in this area of the world in terms of in Toronto were the trees that were in the Rouge. And that's because they were a forest, because they were native, because they had good root systems, because they were there supporting each other. Oh, the big ice storm comes, and they're the trees that do the best. So we need to be thinking about how we plant, what we plant, how we keep forests in and around us all the time. And it's not enough to just build these suburbs that are, yes, we need housing, yes, we need affordable housing, but if we aren't also building in a way that integrates nature, then that weakens the entire system. So we have to see nature as actually providing strength. And when you talk about jobs, there's two or three different ways that they do create jobs, I would say. One is, like, national urban parks tend not to be a place where you pay a fee. Mm-hmm. And that's because they usually have so many different entry points, because they'll have roads going through them, right? So with so many access points, you can't really put a big visitor center and say you must pay, you know, $10 to enter, right? So they don't really earn money that way, but they do create more visits, more spin-offs, like, for example, maybe a tea house or a pub who might have more activity in and around that area because more people are visiting the park, or a local place that might be a garden center or something like that that will be adjacent to the park where people want to stop in as well, or you know, just increasing the value of homes because they have a beautiful vista of that park. And I know when we were working on the creation of Ojibwe in Windsor, one of the first meetings I went to was a meeting where we had a lot of Americans there. And I was like, why are they here to talk about the creation of Ojibwe? And it was because they have conservation issues on their side of the border where they're dealing with a lot of birds and in particular raptors. And they were very interested to see what was going to happen in Canada because birds don't actually know there's a border. So they're kind of like, oh, great, you're going to create this park. This will be fabulous. This will help our raptors. They'll have more space for the raptors to hang out and use. And so this was seen as a big thing. And it also is at the area that's going to be essentially at the base of the new Gordie Howe Bridge. And so it's like, well, when people come over that bridge, you know, they're going to see a national urban park as a destination for a picnic or a place to go. And it will create economic opportunities in the area, may increase, you know, visitors, that kind of thing. So these are all different ways. But then in addition to that, I would say when cities look to national urban parks, it's only part of the mosaic. So the mosaic or the web of life that we're trying to reweave, national urban parks, city parks, ecological corridors, rewilded areas, areas that you might not even consider, might be riverbanks, et cetera. Sometimes in the past, what we've done is said, oh, well, let's just put concrete around these, but actually starting to treat them as wild areas that actually can keep species there, et cetera, will be beneficial to again, you know, those bursting rivers that'll absorb the water as opposed to overflowing on a concrete bank. And so starting to see those as opportunities. And when Green Infrastructure Ontario did a big study in Ontario to look at if you were to actually purposely align and start to create as much green infrastructure as you could in Ontario, the math that they did said it would create about 130,000 jobs by 2030. And that was before the pandemic when they did that study. So Canada hasn't necessarily aligned around that, but that's the kind of metrics that it was also about being a job creator and a risk reducer in terms of climate impacts.
There's a cultural thing to it as well. Like, I think yesterday in Montreal, weather goes above 20 degrees Celsius, I think for the third time in 6 days. It's been a pretty cold, pretty snowy winter. Now all the snow is pretty much melted. But going for a walk around the plateau, going for a walk around like one of the railway lines where there's a trail and stuff like that, the volume of people out about running, cycling, playing with kids, like Laurier Park completely full. It's those kind of things. Like, there's the benefits of the shops and retailers around. There's the benefits to all the people who bought the sporting equipment to do the things that they're doing. There's the care for people to be outside. People are happier and people are healthier. So it's the burden on the healthcare system changes when you have these things available. And if you go a little bit further away, when you start to see these bits of rewilding by the river, so that when it floods, and like you mentioned, I think it's those kind of things connecting that to development is a really, really special piece, because there's another world of conservation where people roll their eyes at them. And maybe this is where you tell me I'm wrong, but I think a really nice example is in Toronto, where you had those trees that were being cut down because of the Ontario Line station. And I think there's different arguments for this, but you have that development could have been done differently so you don't have to get rid of those trees. But we spend a lot of time arguing over 3 or 4 trees for the purpose of a project that should ultimately get lots of cars off the road. And I think we end up getting this lost sometimes in the conservation realm. Developers look at conservation types with the sort of, God, I've got to deal with them again. And actually, really, the conservation type tends to be quite in favor of development, but it's doing development in the right way. And if you get the conservation type, then the developer's development is more resilient and works better and looks nicer. And I think we're lost in that world sometimes of we need to connect these dots and these threads. And you've talked about that through the bulk of this conversation, but I think like I really want to hammer that point home.
Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely vital that we think about development and reweaving the web of life need to be done hand in hand. And how do we do that? And how do we do it efficiently? You know, whether it's having green roofs, having ecological corridors, having urban and rural spaces, connectivity that can, you know, different puzzle pieces, if you will. And I would say there's also a benefit to definitely to people's health, definitely to the economy, definitely in terms of risk reduction, in terms of climate change. People are happier, but sometimes there's things that occur where we just don't really think it through. So for example, there's 800 trees that have just been taken down at the Ontario place to build this spa idea. And, you know, whether you agree with it or you don't agree with it, what the one of the impacts of that was it displaced a bunch of wildlife. And so we have had massive conflicts with coyotes just down on the mainland area. But those coyotes that were going out and using those spaces are now, you know, in conflict with humans and having conflicts with their dogs and wildlife. And it's
all the runners on the waterfront. I see
exactly
in running clubs. I'm not one of them, but you see, and like they're the sort of there's great photos of them sort of standing on benches, like with a stick trying to hold off a coyote.
Yep.
Like that's yep. why they're doing it. Yeah.
And it's massively increased the number. I mean, there have been emergency meetings called, and how do we do this? Now? And nobody thought that through. Nobody sat down and said, let's do the environmental assessment here. And it's not because the wildlife all of a sudden did this. It's because we thoughtlessly went in there and took those 800 trees down and removed all of that area where nature was living. So it's on us. We need to think about these things before we make decisions and make them consistent with our values and not just one value. And so it's not even a balancing, it's being smart. And it's being smart about how you do that. I mean, I'm a really big fan of the Medway because of that, because it's actually bringing back an ecological corridor area. And in fact, the Greenbelt goes all the way up through Tobermory, up through the escarpment there. It's important to be always looking at how you can take advantage of things. And what we try to do is think about it from a, how do you build on purpose connectivity from a farmer's field to a city center? How can you do that? And what does that look like? And it's really quite amazing when you sit down to think that through. We often will take a floor map out to a community meeting or a place and say, well, look, we've got this map. Here's all the areas that are still somewhat green, maybe could be green, that kind of thing. We sit down and say, okay, well, this is where we're thinking a corridor could go. And then usually people come and they're going, oh, well, you know, that property's up for sale and the house is dilapidated and, oh, it'd be really good if we could rewild this, or, you know, oh, there's this area over here that was owned by this company. You know, it's a box store and it could be brought to life. And, oh, that connects to, you know, Mary's farm over here. And maybe we could talk to her about lands that she has. And we could actually build, like Rouge has, it's connected through the Greenbelt, but it actually goes up to, it actually could be a connectivity corridor all the way up to Algonquin. Mm-hmm. And as we go past some of these areas, there are areas where there is forestry. Some of that forestry is FSC certified. Under an FSC, which is Forest Stewardship Certification, they're required to set aside some lands for protection. So then it becomes a question of, okay, well, you're going to do protection anyway because you want to keep your certificate. So I know, instead of doing it over here on this side of your parcel, do it this way because it will actually create better connectivity. And that's where we specialize. We can often go in and sit down with a company or a community and say, well, here's your options. And when you start to do that, like we've just started to look at Uxbridge and its connectivity. One of the things I was going to say since I last spoke with you is one of the big things that's happened around Rouge is it's growing by 50%.
Yeah.
Because there was...
what's not happening, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was, 53 years ago, they expropriated that land and everybody kept saying there was going to be an airport. I think after, you know, 40 years, it became blatantly obvious it wasn't going to happen. But we, you know, some folks still kept the dream alive. And now finally, we've had the government initiate the transfer of land. And the farmers who are there, because it's essentially farm fields and natural areas, But those farmers are thrilled because they want to be part of Rouge like the other agricultural areas are. And as they become part of Rouge, then they actually start to do projects to improve the ecological integrity of the area. And that's the other thing, is it just gets bigger and bigger because people go, well, hang on a sec, I've got this parcel. Oh, why don't we add that? Same thing's happening in Windsor. We've got Tecumseh is now saying, well, we've got some land that we could add to that, which is also just adjacent to Windsor, you know, other areas. It is also really important in terms of reconciliation. Like, for example, I think Ojibwe, we're talking about that being co-managed between the Indigenous people and Canada. Similarly, in we don't have co-management in Rouge, but what we have is we have an Indigenous circle, and certainly they're bringing to bear the ways in which they think about the natural world and what that would look like from their perspective. So it's an exciting space to be in, and I really hope that National Urban Parks, but more than that, this idea that you could create essentially a green network of nature in this rural urban landscape, that everybody could feel connected to the natural world and feel like it was helping them live a better life and contributing to their health, their wellness, their connectivity, even as a family, because if it's within 15 minutes, you can get out and walk. It doesn't cost you money. It's not taking a piece of your paycheck, which is, you know, a tough thing right now, right? So it's important to have places that we can go and play and live in and be connected to, and our neighbors. Like, you just have, you're not seeing everybody through a screen. You're actually out there talking to people. If you're walking your dog or you're going for a run or whatever, right? You're seeing people.
I'd like the way you talk about, like, the forestry taking place, and if they want to stay FSC, then you can be collaborative around it, and it's sort of stitching together the map. And if we went back to Doug Ford Spa, this is a debate that we end up getting on either side of. Put a spa by Lake Ontario, beautiful, lovely. I love a good spa. Quebec City has an amazing spa right underwater. They've also done an amazing job with all the waterfront past that, turning it into a place you can go walk, play, cycle, even jump in the river if you want to. But where the developers often end up getting to is, it's all or nothing. I'm going to bulldoze all these trees and sod the rest. And actually, you theoretically could have built quite a nice spa there that probably generates quite a lot of money, becomes a tourist attraction locals enjoy going to, and kept the trees and the wildlife around it. And I think the way you talk about it's these maps and the connectivity of it. It's like, sometimes I feel like we get lost into this sort of shouting at each other. And I might have come back to this a couple of times, but you talk about that forestry example further north, and it's because you have the map, because you have the, here's my interest, here's your interest, you can come to an outcome that is better than, I keep saying this phrase, but like, more interestingly less wrong. It might not be the perfect solution, but it moves you forward. And I think that that's so important from the work that you do, because that's the lesson I kind of take away.
Yeah, I think it's about building a collaborative space around how can you make this a very thriving area, and not just, great, we've got a great big shiny new spa, right? But what does the area look like if we want to make, and even, for example, if you had maybe gone ahead with the spa but kept some of the trees, you still might have ended up with a coyote problem, right? And so, or like, we didn't consider that. We didn't think about it. And so in the absence of that and just shoving it in, it created a negative impact. And so I personally and organizationally, we have not been a big fan of putting a spa there. Could there have been better places? Because I think even in terms of the transit infrastructure, I don't think it's there to support the number of visitors that they're going to talk about. So
it's okay. They're doing a 20,000 car park.
So. Yeah. Well, that part of the city is very difficult to travel through anyway. So I just don't think it's going to be a good idea. But regardless, I think what your point is, though, is this idea that if you create a collaborative space that isn't just about trying to turn it into, you know, the Joni Mitchell and paved over a parking lot, right? Like, turn it into this big concrete jungle. Mm-hmm. Then it becomes more interesting to live in. It becomes a place that you actually feel like is alive. Because it is, right? Like, and then you're part of that aliveness. And all these cities, whether it's London, like, my mom's in a long-term care facility, and her place backs out onto one of the ecological sensitive areas. And you could see animals roaming there, and she has a beautiful view, and you can spend time watching all this wildlife. It's in the heart of London, Ontario. You know, same thing with the Thames. It goes right through London. Same thing with Guelph. And there they wanted to turn the old reformatory lands into a national urban park. And that is an area where Indigenous people were incarcerated. And they see it as an act of reconciliation because it will create this nature area and add to the natural areas in Guelph that everybody can then go and be part of. So it's, and I also think it helps us knit together city to farm and not have farmers feel like we're just adjacent and we're not seen as part of the mosaic. And I think farmers want to be part of that mosaic. Certainly what I've seen with Rouge and all the projects that they're doing, whether it's, you know, regenerative plantings or whether it's improving the hydrology or, you know, endangered species plantings, those kinds of things. It's all helping and it's contributing. And yeah, I think it's amazing when you can start seeing how everybody can be part of building the mosaic. And whether it's I've got milkweed in my backyard to get those butterflies, or I've got plants that pollinators like. And you see, you go into neighborhoods and you see signs up saying, I have a pollinator garden. People are very proud of these things. Mm-hmm. And so I want to see more and more of that. And I think it also reconnects our kids to the natural world. And it will just make us happier, quite frankly. Just make us happier.
I'm quite interested on, you touched on making this equitable earlier. This is totally a stereotype and I'm going to insult some people by saying it, but it's better to sort of make the provocation. But a lot of times when you see those gardens, they're often in quite upper middle class, often quite white neighborhoods. And they're a little bit, and often it's because the people in them have had the resources and the time and the space to go and create those places. And it's not to say they shouldn't, like, they're brilliant things. But often you go to some of the places where it might be more immigrant, less outdoor space, often people working much longer hours, so they don't have the free time and the leisure time to do those things. And I'm totally generalizing and stereotyping. I think it's really interesting when you have to sort of, how do you do that in more places and it's not all following the same playbook so that you create those connections effectively?
Yeah, and I think that's why when cities are looking at their tree canopy cover or natural vegetation, we're starting to see more and more cities identify the areas that are more barren and saying, what's going on here? And sometimes it's not only the affluent. Like you can get into downtown areas where it's just like thick with condos, right? And there's no nature. And so I think you have both of those things going on. Sometimes the very affluent who are in really dense areas where there's no nature. And then how do you create nature where there are no trees or there's no access to nature? How do you start to rethink that? And some of that is actually helped along, like actually Uxbridge was helped created this way, was that developers actually are required to set aside a certain portion of land. So in Uxbridge, and don't quote me on this, but I know it's going to be on the podcast, but I believe it was the mayor who sat down with the developers and, you know, they're required to set aside certain parcels of land. But again, kind of like the forestry story, said, well, why don't we set aside these parcels because it'll actually be connected. And then once that happens, then other people say, well, what about this other parcel? What about this other parcel? You see that these opportunities to grow things and to knit them together become something that people get excited about. I think that it's, so developers can sometimes be part of the solution because they're going, oh, well, I'm required to have X amount of green space. If I'm building a condo, I have to have X amount of green space. Oh, I could put a green space on the top of the tower that I'm building, or oh, look, I could build something here and it will make the people in my building happier. It will be connected maybe into a ravine system or some other place. Maybe it even runs adjacent to a school park or something like that. And it will double the size that people have access to because those two things are connected. And then that makes the people who live in my building a little bit happier. And if they're happier, they treat the building better. And so you just get all these knock-on effects, right? And so I think what is so exciting about this space of working in this rural urban landscape and seeing what happens in city centers to farmers' fields is that we can all contribute. And if we think about it as being a collaboration of how to reweave the web of life, I think that everybody's going to get really excited about it. We need to stop just plopping down developments because we're going to stick them there and start to think about, well, what could be the knock-on effects, like coyote incursions or whatever, right? And start to think about, well, what does that look like? And it's not even just that the coyotes, it was also a place where birds stopped off. What happens is we have these two flyways in Toronto, the Hummer and the Dawn, and the birds come down and then they have these stop-off points. So yeah, they need space to launch themselves down south. So I think all of this is important to consider, but it's an exciting space. It's a developing space. And we're seeing this happen globally. We're seeing places where they have vegetation targets. We're seeing places where they're rewilding in all kinds of funky places. And it's, you know, where it might be an old transit corridor that they're rewilding, it might be, you know, all different kinds of things. And cities around the world are coming together. I know that Montreal and Toronto are both part of an international city network that's comparing and contrasting notes on what they're doing. It is also the way that we're going to secure various species, because the highest number of endangered species are in and around our cities. So yeah, it's just an exciting space, and it makes people feel good. And it makes them feel like there's a solution.
I like to end these, and this has made me feel good. Like, I come away from conversations like this with, there's loads of things that we need to do better, but we are doing them better. And we're learning to do them better after we've done them a little bit better. I like to end these conversations on, if I gave you a magic wand, we can often get quite caught up into the, here's the constraints that we have, or here's the challenges that we face. And some of them are real and some of them are imagined. But if you had a magic wand to sort of go, that's my wish or my command to make this thing better, to fix this thing, to do something bigger and bolder, what would you do with your magic wand?
Well, if I had a magic wand, I would actually just want to turn this on and amp it up. So I'd want to see nature networks, or this integrated mosaic of nature, created in every city across Canada. And I would do that not only because it would be good for nature and good for the people who live there, but it should also be a massive job creator. It would really help in terms of our climate resilience. And then that actually starts to impact your insurance rates. There are places now, like Windsor is the flood capital of Canada. There are places, a lot of places in Canada, where you can't get flood insurance. Mm-hmm. If you actually started to create nature networks and have them be part of the fabric of your thinking, if we could just wave that magic wand and actually be able to connect all of that thinking so that people didn't think about their city in isolation and didn't think about, you know, Turkey Creek, which goes, it's just adjacent to the proposed Ojibwe National Urban Park. It's concrete. It used to be a natural water course. So that needs to be rewilded. But thinking of that as, oh, this will help my house because I won't get as many floods. You know, thinking in that kind of way, I think if we could do that, I just think this would explode. It would get, people would be much happier in their cities. They'd be much more inclined to be out in their city. They'd be much, like, even just rewilding or making a lot more trees and nature along our city streets makes them more desirable to walk on. People will actually choose to go walk on this street versus that street because it's got more plants, more shade, more beauty.
Yeah.
And so that will get people out. It will have people spending money and engaging with, and less in our cars and in our boxes. So if I could have a magic wand, I would just say, let's create these nature networks all across Canada.
I love that. And I like how you've touched on a little bit of that. There's the altruistic side of it, and there's a touch of the selfish.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
That's an important piece. So it's rare to find someone who's so heavily into conservation, like, hitting those points, but I love that.
Oh yeah. The solution has to make you like the Greenbelt is untouchable for a reason. People come out and defend it because it hits their heart.
Yeah.
They love it. Right. And you know, they drive through it. They see the beautiful colors of the trees. They love it. You can't touch it, as some politicians have found out. So it's really important that is, if we could make every city have a place like a greenbelt, a meadowway, a national urban park, just think how much happier everybody would be.
Here's to that, Jan. Oh, a lovely note to end on. Thank you so much.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. It's been a lovely conversation.
There we go. That was such a lovely note to end on. And I think we need more positive stories like that. So thank you for listening all the way through to here again. And as we do more of these, let me know what you think. Share it widely. Comment away. And if there's people you want to recommend for future episodes, get in touch. Let me know. Connect us up. Thanks very much. Cheers to Being Challengers.